It's always a special pleasure when I can speak with a local author, and especially when the book that they have written proves to be a really wonderful book. And that is the case with the book that we're going to be talking about today. It's called Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Browns Lake. Browns Lake is located just north, northeast of Lake Geneva, and just about straight west from Racine. So many of you probably have at least heard of Browns Lake and maybe even been there and seen it. I suspect, however, that most of you have no idea just how fascinating its history is. I certainly didn't until I read this really lovely and interesting book written by Carol DeMarco. And Carol is one of the people who is lucky enough to live on Browns Lake. Sure, she and her family have lived there since 1976. And we're going to find out from her about what prompted her to research the history of Browns Lake and some of the interesting people who have lived there. And then we'll delve into a few of the intriguing stories which she shares in this book. Again, the book is called Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Browns Lake. And Carol DeMarco, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
I'm just delighted about this. As I was telling you before we went on the air, the fact that WGTD's signal now reaches into Burlington and Lake Geneva and so on means that we take very seriously our obligation, our responsibility to be covering news events out there in the county and bringing to morning show listeners interesting people with interesting stories. So it's great to have you here. Ahead of us talking about the writing of this book, tell us a little bit about where you come from originally and how your family eventually settled on Browns Lake, I believe, back in 1976.
Well, originally, I was born in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Went on to the University of Wisconsin, where I met my husband, Tony DeMarco, who is from the Chicago area. Soon after graduation, we settled in the Chicago area. But having gone to Wisconsin and Madison and being on that wonderful Lake Mendota, we were both taken with lake living. So as time progressed, we started looking at lake homes, thinking about getting a summer cottage. And then we both said, why don't we just move to a lake? My husband traveled for business, so we were able to live practically anywhere. So we started our search. And we came across this wonderful old home on Browns Lake in Burlington, Wisconsin. And it's been a wonderful ride since that day in November of 1976. So that's how we started our residence on Browns Lake.
So tell us what prompted you to explore something about the history of Browns Lake. And I don't even know if that's simultaneously then when you started writing this book. But at some point, you evidently got curious. What spurred your curiosity about Browns Lake and some of the people who had lived there?
Well, what spurred my curiosity before we even moved in happened at the closing, when we were closing on the house. And they handed me an abstract of title, which in fact was a packet of paper, probably at least a half inch thick, of page after page of history of who used to own that home. Now, the home was built in 1898. So as soon as I started looking at the abstract, I said to myself, you know, I should start delving into this and seeing who used to live in the house before we did. So that's what sparked my interest.
Sorry. So in other words, you had at least names of who had previously owned the house, but you didn't know anything about them. So you thought, wouldn't it be fun to know the story behind some of these people?
And, you know, I was a history minor at the university, an English major, but history is definitely something that I enjoy. So as soon as I saw this abstract, I thought, yes, let me start looking at this. So we moved into the house, met some of the wonderful people who live on Browns Lake, and I started telling them about my curiosity. And they started suggesting that I talk to some of the old-timers on the lake. And this is in 1970, so some of these people had lived on the lake as early as toward the turn of the century.
Wow.
And so it was so wonderful that I was able to speak with some of these folks. So that also got me started. And that's when I decided, you know, the history of this house is nothing compared to the history of the whole lake. And that's where I broadened my perspective. To begin with, the first page of the abstract was Richard Brown. And Richard Brown was the man who the lake was named after. Originally, though, the name of the lake was a Potawatomi word, which meant Lake of the Shining Arrow.
Mm.
And if you look at the cover of the book, a good friend of mine took this photo on a beautiful full moon July night. And how the Potawatomi came across this name was to look at the moon shining across the lake and forming a beautiful arrow.
Mm.
And actually, we'll be seeing that around August 1st or 2nd this year. This is when the moon's going to be doing that same trick.
So it needs to be at a particular place in the sky.
It needs to be at a particular place in the sky. And actually, there'll be sailboats going out at midnight to pass through the light of the moon over the lake. It's really quite beautiful.
Wow. So hence the title of the book, then, Lake of the Shining Arrow. So those of you just joining us, I want to make sure you know that I'm talking with Carol DeMarco, who lives on Brown's Lake and undertook a study of the many different people who have lived in and around Brown's Lake over the generations, and has written then this fascinating book called Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Brown's Lake. So you were spurred by sort of this packet of documents in terms of those who had previously owned your own home, and did a little talking to a few of the old-timers who also lived around the lake, some of them who probably are not with us anymore. What were some other means by which you were able to fill in a lot of the gaps? Because I'm just thunderstruck by how much information is in this book. I mean, to what sorts of sources did you turn to learn as much as you did about Brown's Lake and the people who lived on its shores?
Well, Greg, I owe a huge debt to the Burlington Historical Society. And what happened, if I may back up, was that I began, as I said, interviewing some people and looking into as much old literature, going to the in Madison to the Wisconsin Historical Society, and truthfully, I was coming up with very little. But in the meantime, let's take us to about 1977 or 78. I started a business of my own, and my two sons, of course, needed my attention as a mom, and so the book got shelved. It just got put. It was all in a box, and it got put aside. And it wasn't until, but it stayed in my heart and in my soul, and I did clippings and kept everybody aware of my interest. It wasn't, though, until about 2008 that I got back to it. It was that long.
Wow, decades went by.
It was decades. But, you know, history can wait for you. History will still be there. So the lovely part was that in those decades, guess what? Computers came by. And believe me, when you ask how I was able to collect all this information, I never could have done it back in the 70s with what we have now. So one magic day, I called the Burlington Historical Society, talked to a wonderful gentleman named Don Vandesand, who is their curator, mentioned to him that I was looking to do a history of Brown's Lake. He invited me up to the second story of the Historical Society, and gave me some files to look at. And then I heard his printer going and going and going. I thought, what's going on? Well, Don has taken it upon himself to chronicle all the Burlington Standard Press articles starting in 1860. So he pushed the button that says Brown's Lake, came up with another fat packet of documents, and that was every newspaper article written about Brown's Lake since 1860.
Wow.
I felt I had the Rosetta Stone in my hands.
Right.
I thought, this is it. Now I can really write the book. And so that's what got me started. And it was about 5 years worth of on and off doing research, mostly on, and spending time at the Burlington Library where they have a microfiche machine. And there I was with my rolls of film, reading old newspapers and loving every minute of it.
Wow. I suppose one of the challenges with that is that you don't just amass information, but then you have to make sense of it. You have to sort of figure out how much of it you can use and how you're going to use it and in what form that's going to make sense to the reader. I mean, I should think that was, in some ways, as monumental a task or as complicated a task as just getting all this information into your hands.
You're absolutely right. And that took a lot of thinking and a lot of running it past people. And also, I really enjoy reading history. And I look at authors, popular authors like Doris Kearns Goodwin and McCullough and all these folks, Ambrose, people who write these wonderful histories. And I ask myself, what made them so readable? Because history can be very boring. And especially with all these newspaper articles all over the place. So I did read some books, too, about writing history. And one of the key things they said is you don't have to include every single piece of research you've done. You need to pull and glean the ones that stick to your whatever your outline is that you've set for yourself.
Sure. You mentioned, I think, that that you were a history major in college?
Or I was a history minor, English major.
English major, history minor. Well, there you go. In terms of your own background, that's fairly significant. Ahead of writing this book, what kind of writing had you done, if any?
Not much. I always enjoyed it. But I'll tell you, when I was at the university and I was taking a creative writing course, this is the professor back in the 1960s, said to all of his students, those of you who get A's in this class should continue to write and let other people read it. Those of you who get B's should continue to write, but not necessarily ask other people to read it. Well, I got a B.
Oh, dear.
So that was not a very encouraging thing.
That was not the good housekeeping seal of approval.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. So, but I also found out that I'm really not a creative writer. I'm definitely an expository writer, just writing the things I know. I can't make things up.
Not a person of fiction. That being said, however, you really did something quite creative in the way that you put this book together. First of all, at certain points, it is as though we are hearing from the lake itself, as though the lake itself is a person or has a soul and is speaking directly to the reader. Did anything in particular prompt you to make that intriguing choice?
Yes, and actually, on my part, as I said, I'm not creative, so this was a courageous choice because I didn't want to look foolish. But I myself identify with her, with the lake. I look at her and I see her moods. I see her exhaustion at the end of a weekend. I kayak in her and I feel so close to her. And suddenly I thought, you know, rather than looking for a narrator from all these characters I've come across, why don't I just make the lake the main character of the book? I ran that idea past some of my friends who are writers, and they said, ooh, that could be a little corny. But you know what? As I became so comfortable with her as I started writing the book that she just fit right in.
I think it's a great choice. It really, really is. And then the other choice you make, which is in some ways equally intriguing, is that then we hear directly from various people who have lived on the lake. In other words, you have them sharing their stories as sort of first-person testimonies versus writing about them.
And again, that was trying to, and I hope succeeding in, making the book much more readable. If I may, would you like me to describe the different, just quickly, the
sure.
different narrators?
Absolutely.
Okay, I organized it just so your listeners, if they're interested in reading it, will know the topics that I cover. And for each topic, I've chosen one person to be a narrator. For example, I began with the Indians, the Potawatomi Indians who lived around Browns Lake. And to be the narrator of that, the lake introduces us to Chief Bigfoot, who in fact was the chief of the Potawatomi in Lake Geneva, and one of his minor bands lived on Browns Lake. But Chief Bigfoot is the one who narrates that first chapter and takes us through the sadness of the Indian dispersal and all the details of that. Then the next chapter, I started thinking, you know, before the government could take control of all this land after they kicked the Indians out, they needed to get this surveyed. So I started investigating the surveyors. Wow, what an interesting bunch of risk takers and businessmen. A lot of these surveyors ended up quite wealthy at the end because they knew where the good land was.
Right. And if I just may interject, I think that's such a good choice and also something that probably wouldn't occur to a lot of people that would be interesting. I mean, we think about the work that surveyors do. I don't know. I for one, don't think of that as particularly fascinating work or anything I might be interested in investigating further. And I'm so glad that your curiosity led you to want to explore that, because it's one of the most interesting parts of the book, I think.
It fascinated me, number one, that all the documents are still available, all the drawings. I found the name of the man who did the surveying. His name was John Brink. And again, thank goodness for computers. I Googled John Brink, and what came up but a long article he wrote describing all his experiences as a surveyor. It was wonderful.
Wow.
Then the next ones that I went with were the early settlers, the first people who bought land from the government at $1.25 an acre, who bought land. And they were people who came from, they were Yankees from the East Coast because it was getting way too crowded, a lot of Germans from Westphalia, and some English people. And of all those folks that bought land around Browns Lake, the lake selected a man named John Hawkins, and he had quite an interesting background. Came from England, was a temperance man, and then started his property, his farm on the lake. After that, then next chapter that I wrote about was the island, and I know you have not been to the lake, but the lake has a 3.75 acre island. And it started off being occupied by squatters and then ended up being sold to a group of merrymakers. This was in the 1870s. And the narrator for that is a gentleman named Eddie Wells, a Burlington dandy, who did quite well in business and gathered up a bunch of people from Kenosha, Racine, Chicago, and Milwaukee to build I won't call it a mansion. I'll call it a clubhouse on the lake. And they had lots of celebrations, and bands would come out, and they'd dance, and just had a gay old time. And there'd be a ferry that would take them back and forth across, a pulley-operated ferry. And then of course, there were now, a lot of your listeners will probably know Browns Lake because of the resorts. And there were five resorts on the lake, and for each resort, I have selected one of the resort founders or one of the people most known to own the resorts. And the first one is Roy Moore from the Moore's Lakeside Resort, famous for gambling and catered to a Jewish population. In those days, people were separated themselves from each other. And Moore's catered to mostly Chicago Jewish people. And at the end, in the 1950s, a lot of your listeners will probably remember the World Series when the New York Yankees stayed at Moore's Resort. Then there were several other resorts, Cerami's and Liggett's. Liggett's is another one that a lot of listeners will probably remember because there was a lot of fun to be had at Liggett's. But anyway, each of these resorts is described by its owners. And then I divided the lake into four parts for the cottagers. These are the people who came and built what they called cottages, but in fact, some of which were pretty substantial homes, ours being one of them, as a matter of fact. One of these big old Victorian things.
That to a certain person might seem like a cottage, but to a lot of the rest of us might look more like a mansion.
It depends
on where you're coming from.
Now, of course, we're not comparing this to Lake Geneva. That's the big sister of of cottages.
Right.
This is more the, you know, the secondary. But anyway, I divided that into one of the characters is Florence Hall. A part of the lake is named after her, Hall's Point, and she did seances, and she was a psychic, and she ran the bank in Burlington for a while. I mean, she was just the most colorful, interesting woman of the 1890s. Unheard of. And so that's what I mean. As I researched, I was finding out more than about the lake. As you said, finding more about the people. Chapter 7 are the ice houses. Did you know that ice was produced on the lake and sold to Chicago?
Had no idea.
Well, I'd heard about it from one of the old-timers way back when, and he said, what a shame. These ice houses were such a blight on the landscape. But in fact, there was a lot of money that was made in ice until the refrigerator was invented.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's great about a book that chronicles history is that it takes us back to a different time when things were done very differently than they are now. And it helps us rethink things that we maybe utterly take for granted.
You know, speaking of that, to this day, I can either walk, drive, or paddle around the lake, and I can't help but put myself back in those times. And there are a couple of places that are still actually intact and look the way they did during those days. And then I think to myself, this weekend was the 4th of July, and I think I went around the lake and said, you know what? Everybody's having fun in the same way that they used to.
Right.
Something's never changed, and it was lovely to think that.
Sure, we still like picnics, we still like fireworks, we still like being
water,
together.
Like having the family out and have sailboat races, and yeah, so it's, I think that's the loveliness of it, is to know that it really hasn't changed that much. And then at the end of the book, I talk about, there's a lot of interesting things. We had a crippled children's camp in the lake. We talk about Prohibition. We talk about Al Capone, of course, made his mark, I think, on every lake in southeastern Wisconsin. And ours was no exception. There was a major shooting that went on. Capone sent a couple of his thugs out to get even with a guy named Lefty Lynch, who was not about to give up his position as the coal dealer for the unions in Chicago. So Al sent his thugs after him, and the thugs thought they got Lefty, but in fact they just grazed his leg and his hand. But it makes for a pretty dramatic story. And then the last chapter, I thought, ugh, I have to do this. It's going to be so boring. And it's about conservation on the lake. And again, I started doing the research, and oh my gosh, it was fascinating. Fascinating over the years to see what people have done to keep this lake as healthy as possible. So it ends with a tour of Browns Lake. There's a map at the end, and it takes you around the lake and describes who used to live in certain places and who lives there now. So actually, I have given some tours by boat, just taking people on the boat and taking them around the lake, people who've read the book. So, and I must say it's been well-received in the Burlington area, and I loved every minute of it. Researching it and writing it.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Carol DeMarco, and we are talking about the book which she has lovingly crafted over the course of decades, actually, a book called Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Browns Lake. And Lake of the Shining Arrow, that's what Browns Lake was originally called by the Potawatomi. I actually want to start with that last chapter, that chapter called Conservation, which really has some interesting things. And I want to just read a little bit of this to give our listeners a sense of the way in which you write in the voice of the lake. So again, the primary narrator through the book, introducing the various chapters and then commenting on them, is Browns Lake itself or herself. So here's how this ninth chapter begins. The final chapter of my story is the tale of my heroes, the lake people who have looked out for my survival. For well over a century, they have protected my depth, my health, and my fish. In the 1970s, they rescued me from sure death. Who better to tell the tale than I, Browns Lake, the Lake of the Shining Arrow? And then you go on to recount that it was actually long ago, not long after the Potawatomi left for resettlement in Kansas, that there's already trouble. And I think for a lot of us, we would imagine that there wouldn't be any kind of trouble for a place like Browns Lake until modern life really takes hold. But what were some of the first issues that threatened, in a sense, the health of Browns Lake?
You know, the first issues were the farmers. The farmers were trying to increase their land holdings around the lake. Therefore, they were draining and damming up and making the lake smaller so they could have more tillable land. On a much larger scale, it reminds me of water issues in California. And, you know, the wave agriculture tries to take over and, you know, for their own needs. Then after a while, of course, the invention of the old Evinrude engine. Before that, people paddled and wallowed, and the lake was doing just fine until, as our lake says, that stinky old engine came in, and Ollie Evinrude said, "Don't row, throw the oars away."
So that was the big advertising slogan for these new motors. And so the lake, for the first time then, has boats on it that are powered by gasoline and oil. And one imagines that some of those early engines, early motors, probably leaked and caused all kinds of trouble.
And, of course, people then began, more and more of the land was subdivided. The farmers gave up all that land eventually, and person after person was moving in and building, at that time, little cottages with very little plumbing facilities, maybe septic tanks, but you can well imagine. So it was in the, I believe, 40s when a group of caring men surreptitiously put colored tissue into the toilets of one of the resorts and then flushed it and then saw where it ended up in the lake, directly into the lake. It was kind of a sneaky thing to do, but it worked. And before you know it, a sanitary commission was developed. They put sewers around the lake. They started a weed control, all kinds of things. It took years and years for that to happen.
That was especially a surprise to me to read about the matter of weeds, because I don't think most of us would think that that's any big deal. But evidently that did become something of a serious issue.
It did. And now we have a weed control program that goes around daily, and it's just constantly cutting down, pulling up, and getting rid of weeds on the lake. And actually, you know, a lot of inland lakes are that way. There's a picture in the book of the weedy South Shore in the 1890s. That was before any pollutants. But it's just certain areas of the lake could be weedy.
You also write about the matter of dead fish, which, of course, that's also one of the less pleasant realities of inland lakes particularly.
Well, in this case, the fish kill was done deliberately. and that was to rid the lake of these massive carp, which could be as big as 6 feet long, I'm sorry to say. So they did a fish kill, and that is they put in a certain poison that affected only gill-breathing animals. Can you imagine what that was like in the 1960s, having all the gill-breathing animals rising to the surface? And so all the population of the lake and the Boy Scouts and all kinds of volunteers hauled all these fish out, and then the DNR came and replanted bass and bluegill and all the wonderful fish that now occupy the lake.
When you describe this on, it was September 16th, 1971, it spread my surface with a chemical that suffocated the fish by coating their gills. Almost immediately, 20,000 pounds of fish sank to the bottom where they were left to decay. The majority, over 40 tons, floated to the top. Here are the census figures. 80% carp, 15% stunted bluegill, 1% northern pike, and only 3% bass. Pathetic numbers that showed just how sick I had become. I think what you're describing there is when, in a sense, the wrong kind of fish are allowed to predominate, then you have a really, then you have a in a sense, a sick ecosystem that needs to be righted somehow.
That's correct. And, of course, you have all the interests. You have the water skiers and the recreational boaters who love, you know, everybody is there for their reason. And what it takes is this cooperative effort. That's the key, as in anything else in life. And that fish kill was a cooperative effort.
We're speaking with Carol DeMarco about her book, Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Browns Lake. It's a truly fascinating book. And it's one of those things where I think just at a glance, one might not even imagine it would be as interesting. You yourself, as you started writing this, I mean, had no idea just how fascinating these stories would be. And, of course, we don't have time to probe into great detail about very much of the book, but I do want to talk about a couple of things. I'm so glad that you begin with Native Americans in the first chapter, with the Potawatomi Indians. And I'm curious, first of all, where you went to find as much interesting information as you did when it comes to this, because that's kind of an issue when it comes to Native Americans and their history, is that we as the white folks have sometimes been very selective about what we thought was interesting and what needed to be preserved in the historical record. Where did you go to find out as much as you did about the Potawatomi Indians and their connection to Browns Lake?
I think most of it was the libraries and the Wisconsin Historical Society. There's a great deal of information on them, on the Potawatomi. As far as their, I thought their connection with Chicago, which is where the treaties were signed, a lot of that came from articles in the Chicago Tribune that described the parties or the gatherings for the treaties. Where they dispersed to, mainly it was definitely through libraries. There weren't that many newspaper articles available, but lots of it in the Historical Society and in the libraries.
One thing you write really intrigued me about the crafting of some of these treaties. At one point you write, Mr. Lewis Cass, governor of the Michigan Territory in the 1820s, said Indians always arrive at the treaty grounds poor and naked and only attend the treaty to get their money. And go on to say, the superintendent of Indian Affairs was angry that the Potawatomis were not becoming farmers. He said, all we did was catch fish and plant patches of corn, dance, paint ourselves, hunt, and get drunk when we could get liquor, fight, and often starve. He thought moving us to the West would save us from the white man and allow us to continue in our old ways. You're really touching on something so intriguing there, namely this chasm of misunderstanding between peoples and this idea that of the presumptions that, for instance, some white official might make about what would make the Native Americans happier or what would keep them safe, and allowing yourself to believe things that, in a sense, give you permission to kick them off of their own land. I mean, you're really touching on something that all of us need to explore and think about further.
I think so. I think it's that same mistake that we humans make so often, and that's to want to make everyone just like us. Hmm. And to this day, you hear about those Indian boarding schools where they did it out of good intentions. Took these kids away from their parents, put them into boarding schools, cut their hair, wouldn't allow them to speak their native tongues, and all that in hopes of assimilating them. And there are just certain places in the human existence that you can't make everyone just like everyone else. But, you know, it's still a problem.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a sad, sad situation. I thought one of the things about the Indians and the white men being so afraid of them was that the Indians, a lot of them, I know there was a lot of shooting and killing going on, but a lot of them would come into, for example, the people who lived around Browns Lake, they would come into their house and think that they could just pick up food. They just assumed everybody shared.
The way that they did.
Exactly. Or they wanted to touch these white babies and see what they look like. They would come in a house because they didn't know what a staircase looked like. They'd never seen a staircase. So a lot of it was innocence.
Right. You know? Innocence misunderstood then.
Right.
Yeah. Let's touch on chapter two, because this is, as we talked earlier, sort of an area of subject matter that a lot of us would have thought, oh, no, let's just skip over that. Let's get to the interesting stuff, when in fact you were able to uncover a great deal of really interesting information about the surveyors and the work that they did, and in particular, this certain government surveyor who is the narrator of this chapter, one John Brink. And we actually see the original map, which John Brink himself drew in terms of surveying Browns Lake. First of all, can you just kind of summarize what a surveyor does, and in particular, what these surveyors were doing with a place like Browns Lake? What responsibility were they entrusted with?
Well, the government hired them, and they were actually based in Cincinnati, Ohio. Because remember, this was just, we're talking 1830, 1840. So this was just blank territory.
Yeah, we're not a state yet.
No, we're just a territory. And so Cincinnati was the source of where they were trained. And they were trained in a very rigorous manner using a French protocol of measuring and delineating spaces and squaring things off into sections. And so what these guys would do, they'd get their team together, and there'd be the head, like John Brink. But then with him, he would have a whole team of, he'd have cooks, he'd have some of the people needing to do the chopping, getting through. Mm. I mean, just picture just barren land. Actually, they followed Indian paths most of the time. That would make sense, wouldn't it?
But yeah, I guess that's part of what we have to remember is they are trailblazing. They are exploring where very much is the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't often think about that. In fact, you know, right where we live, it's hard for us to sort of take us back to that sort of area. A little later in the book, it's actually chapter four. You are talking about the island, and the first stories about the island involve its nickname of Island Wild. Island Wild. Tell our listeners what prompted the island perched in the middle of Browns Lake to be called Island Wild and how it lived up to that nickname.
Well, this all happened soon after the Civil War, when it was very fashionable for these Civil War veterans to buy up surplus tents and pitch them in natural places, places like along lake shores. And picture one night, a summer night in the 1870s, the narrator, Eddie Wells, a gentleman from Burlington, along with a couple of Burlington business people, were with a gentleman from Racine named Fred Wild. And he had grown into a very important railroad man at this point. He, you know, he started small, but the railroads just grew and grew. And he was probably the most well-known freight manager for the whole country. But the reason he was well-known is because of his personality. He was just one of these once-in-a-lifetime characters who was constantly coming up with ideas to have a good time. Well, here they are, pitched in their tent on the shoreline of Browns Lake, looking out over this island. And Fred said, I heard that this place was not put up during the land sale. Nobody owns it. This is 1870. So I'm sure, fired by a few spirits, they got together a plan to go out to a land sale that was going on in Monadnina or someplace like that. And they bought up the island for, I think, $19. That was their bid. Mm. And the reason they did it was so that they'd have a place to gather and have fun. They started off in tents and eventually built a very substantial clubhouse. And before you know it, they started having lots of parties and lots of singing. Singing was very popular in those days. And they kind of were making fun of revival. Remember the revival tents that they'd put up,
right,
the revivalists? That was during that era. Well, these gentlemen were ridiculing that revivalist era, and they named Island Wild the group. The group named themselves the Gideons, which referred to a biblical passage about singers who would make so much noise they'd scare the enemy away.
Mm.
And that's what these fellas did. So Fred Wild became the head of the Gideons, along with, by the way, I might add, J.I. Case was also a very active member.
I like one description you have here from a newspaper. The local newspaper had described the Gideonites as wealthy young men of Burlington, Racine, and various other places, of energetic and romantic dispositions, pleasure lovers in every sense of the word, who set themselves at work to beautify and improve the island. And then you're kind of left to your imagination
That's
to wonder
right.
what all of that even
and
means.
And they would even import, they would have Ladies' Day. Of course, this was a gentleman's island. But once a year in the summer, they'd have the ladies come out, and they would come for a three-day encampment. And along with the Williams and Severance Band, which was a big band in Milwaukee. Now, picture, this is on an island. This is, it's primitive. And yet they made it lovely. And I do include a menu in here of they served, which was quite substantial. Roasts and fish and vegetables and, of course, wines and claret. And they had a cook. And, they had a great old time on the island.
And as you explore some of the resorts that were constructed on the shores of Browns Lake, of course, you also share with us really interesting details along the way that, you know, for instance, the one you already mentioned, a Christian couple who nevertheless decided that their resort would cater to more of a Jewish clientele. And you quote that owner as saying that that's a decision we absolutely never regretted, and their resort very much flourished. In other cases, when you're describing these resorts, you're also describing those that permitted or did not permit gambling or the different kinds of dances, according to whatever the sort of passing fad was. And, of course, certain places go out of style or for whatever reason become run down or the lake becomes too crowded. Your book is not just about what emerges. Your book is also about what fades away. And I suppose that's maybe a little more of melancholy reality that's part of any place here in America.
Absolutely. It's part of the story, part of what happens. I might add that there was another Jewish resort across the way from Moore's, and that was a kosher Jewish resort. So there was no dance. Well, there was dancing, but there was no drinking. There was no gambling. And Jack Benny used to bring his father, there to play cards with the man from, it was called Becker's Resort. But then, of course, Jack Benny and his cohorts would go across the lake to Moore's, where there was gambling and drinking. In the meantime, Milton Berle would put his people up at the kosher resort, and the writers would test their material on the waitresses and the cleaning ladies and all that. So there was, you know, it was like the Borscht Belt of the Midwest. And as you said, it certainly faded because those kinds of things come and go.
They do. Well, the story is just so fascinating, and of course we haven't even touched on some of the really intriguing families who made their homes, whether they be year-round homes or just summer homes or whatever, but who populated and continue to populate this beautiful thing called Brown's Lake. And start to finish, this book is absolutely fascinating, and it makes you wish that, there were books like this about all kinds of different places, and not just lakes, but places where things that we, on the surface, seem to be the most ordinary and mundane. You dig beneath the surface and you find all kinds of fascinating stuff that is worth exploring and knowing. The book, again, is called Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Brown's Lake. And, Carol, if people are intrigued, how can they get a copy?
Well, first of all, there is a website. It's called Burley Books, Burley as in Burlington, burleybooks.com. On it are also two books that my husband wrote. Now, he writes novels.
Ah.
So he's the fiction guy, and they're very good, good mysteries. But anyway, burleybooks.com.
And how do you spell that?
B-U-R-L-I books.com. The second thing is that you can buy it through Amazon. So look up DeMarco, D-E-M-A-R-C-O, or Lake of the Shining Arrow. You can order it through Amazon. And then we have it for sale in Burlington at the pharmacy station and at the Pine Street Coffee Shop, which is on right downtown.
Very good.
So, thank you. The book
again is Lake of the Shining Arrow, A History of Brown's Lake. And Carol DeMarco, as you can tell, I love the book, and I hope a lot of people will seek it out and explore it. And I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has really been fun.
Greg, thank you so much for inviting me.
Coming up on 8:58, at 9 o'clock, we will join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Between now and then, we can update you on the weather. The forecast for the National Weather Service for this Thursday, July the 16th, cloudy and mild. 70% chance of rain. A high today is 75. I might bump that up to 100% chance of rain as I look at the radar. It is moving now through the Rockford area. Actually, it's a line of storms that moves from the northwest to the southeast, all the way from back in Minnesota down to Kankakee, moving in a northwesterly direction. So it'll be approaching, it is approaching Waukegan, Kenosha, Racine, and all of us here in southeastern Wisconsin. I would suspect between now and 11 o'clock, depending on how fast or how slow the rain moves. So it will be raining here probably before noon. Tonight, then, cloudy and mild, a 70% chance of more rain, a low of 65. Tomorrow and the weekend, scorchers. Friday, partly sunny, hot and humid, slight chance of rain. Tomorrow's high, 89 degrees. Heat index readings near 95 in the afternoon. And then Saturday and Sunday, partly sunny and very hot, 30% chance of rain both days. Temperatures in the upper 80s both days. Looking ahead to next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, sunny, temperatures in the low 80s. Here are the numbers right now. Humidity high, 81%. It's overcast, 64 degrees for Racine and Kenosha. It is 60 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. 64 as well for Milwaukee, and the wind is calm. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. Once again, at 9 o'clock, we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming.